Welcome to KLCC's Community Conversation, Racism, Hate, Oregon's History, and the Media. We're broadcasting live out of the Selco Performance Hall at KLCC in downtown Eugene. I'm Ani Katz. Some of us might already know some of the bullet points of Oregon's history on this topic. The forced removal of indigenous people from their lands, enacting a series of exclusionary laws in the 1800s, being home to the largest KKK membership per capita in the U.S. in the 1920s, and Oregon was one of the last seven states to ensure all citizens had the right to vote. More recently, the Department of Homeland Security added white supremacy to its list of national domestic terrorism threats. This comes after the director of the FBI told Congress in April that most acts of domestic terrorism are incited by white supremacists. With Oregon's history in mind, what we're going to look at today is where the state finds itself amidst the national dialogue around racism, prejudice, white supremacy, and white nationalism. Let's introduce our guests. Dr. Alicia Moreland Capuya is a certified psychiatrist and an assistant professor at the Oregon Health and Science University School of Medicine in Portland. Dr. Moreland Capuya is the executive director of the Avel Gordley Center for Healing at OHSU and is the co-founder of the Capuya Foundation. We're also joined by Eric K. Ward, the executive director of the Western States Center. Eric is a national expert on the relationship between hate and violence and works on preserving democratic institutions and inclusive societies. He works with various organizations to expose and counter white nationalist groups and protect vulnerable communities. And finally, Professor Christopher Chavez, an associate professor and doctoral program director from the University of Oregon's School of Journalism and Communication. He co-directs Crossing Radio, a joint collaboration with U of O and UNESCO, where they explore intercultural dialogue and conflict-sensitive reporting. He's written about globalization, media, and culture. Thank you all for being here today. Before we get started, if you're just tuning in, we're still accepting questions for our panelists. Send us an email to news@klcc.org, or if you're watching on Facebook Live, leave a comment, or you can tweet at us with the hashtag KLCC on air. So I want to go back to something that I mentioned in our introduction. The KKK had a strong presence here in Oregon in the 1920s. Eric Ward, could you give us some background on how the Klan came to Oregon?
Certainly, and thank you for having me here today. You know, the history of Oregon is unique, and it starts before the arrival of the Klan of the 1920s. Oregon is a territory that enters the United States as a free state. And on the surface, that sounds really good, that it was a state that was opposed to the system of chattel slavery and the forced labor of black people in America. But there's a deeper story. The deeper story is that Oregon enters as a free state because it does not want black people to reside in the state of Oregon at all. Within the territorial constitution is a law that prohibits black people from being here. And I think it's important to recognize that that law at its essence was anti-black, but it was also anti-native. The purpose of that law was to isolate Native people and Native nations here in Oregon to try to contain their power. And there was a fear that Native people and African Americans would unite, and keeping people out was the history. So it's important to understand that Oregon, from its inception, is a contested state. You have individuals like Joseph Lane, where Lane County comes from, who is probably one of the first separatist, white separatist, in Oregon. He is attempting to create a new state that will ally with the Confederacy and is eventually arrested trying to smuggle weapons into Oregon, untold story. And so the arrival of the Klan in the 1920s is actually not surprising once you understand the history of Oregon. In the 1920s, the Klan goes through its second revival, and it is the largest membership of the Klan in the U.S., and it is in Oregon that the Klan really takes root. What is ironic is that it is primarily a anti-Catholic and anti-Jewish movement here in Oregon, because there are not a lot of black people. It rises in power. It influences government institutions and becomes a challenge for the state of Oregon. It's eventually defeated. But its ability to shape policies is quite significant and sets the stage for continued invasions of white nationalists into the Oregon history.
So it does fizzle out, like you mentioned, a little bit. The membership dwindles. Why does that happen?
It fizzles out for several reasons. The first is that the anti-Catholic rhetoric and actions of this movement become quite alarming to city and state leaders. And eventually, leaders begin to step up and slowly begin to condemn the Klan. I also think it begins to fizzle out because at the end of the day, Oregon's anti-blackness denies the Klan the ability to really expand beyond its membership. It's not really able to draw off of the anti-blackness that the Klan is able to draw on in the Midwest or in the South. So eventually it meets its match through resistance of Catholic communities, resistance of the Jewish community, being able to partner with folks who are more concerned about Oregon than moving overt racist policies at that time.
Okay. I'm going to admit that I was a little nervous about today's program, not because it's live radio, but because, quite honestly, conversations about race can be uncomfortable. Dr. Moreland Kapuya, maybe you can get us started on why this is.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me here. And I thought that this would be an appropriate question for the psychiatrist in the group so that we could sort of move in a direction of a little bit of what I call group psychotherapy, which is appropriate in this setting. I'll start out by saying that all of our human natural proclivities is to avoid things that feel like failure, to avoid things that feel hard, and to avoid things that feel difficult. And to the extent that we have to have conversations about things, it gives power to it. And if we give power to it, then it also compels us to have to do something about it. And I think when we talk about racism as a very powerful social construct, that it's one of those things that seems quite colossal when you think about it in nature, because it's so structural and it's so deep-rooted, and it involves many aspects. And so when you say the word racism, and it conjures up a certain emotion, certain feelings, and it also, with that comes things like blame and guilt and shame. And those are all emotions that are sometimes difficult to reconcile. So instead of wanting to deal with it, we want to run away from it. And so one of the things that I have found to be quite effective over time, I don't have these conversations. I have to be honest. To have the conversation about racism and to be an African-American woman at times is exhausting. And it's a burden that I don't feel that I or any other minority group should actually have to carry. The argument that I submit to groups of individuals is that if, in fact, racism is something that we do not wrestle with and thoughtfully deconstruct together, it'll consume us all. So what I know from history is that when something impacts you personally, and I'm saying you as a universal you, then we are more likely to want to change it. So the reframe that I have is to explain racism in this particular aspect, is to break it down into something less colossal, to say, it is really fear. It is hate. But that fear is an interesting phenomenon that I think everyone can understand. So one of the core questions that I ask is there anyone among me who has never been afraid? And no human being I have ever met anywhere, even under a rock, will say that they have never experienced fear. And to the extent that folks can understand what fear is like, how crippling it can be, how damaging it feels, how scary it is, then they're willing to engage at a different level. So if I say that racism is undergirded by this very primal emotion, now I've captured your attention. Now I'm working and operating down your lane, and I've inspired something in you to at least give thought to something that you weren't going to give thought to before. But I can tell you from the work from Dr. Williams, David Williams, at the School of Public Health at Harvard, he has given a really beautiful TED talk on how racism, essentially it's the house that racism built, and the argument that is quite eloquent is that it is making us all sick. And we can see that in current events now. And I will yield the floor because I think that there are more questions that are coming on to address this issue. But it is difficult, and it's meant to be difficult. The last thing I'll say is that nothing in history has ever changed amidst comfort and convenience. And if the real driving force is to have something change, then we must get comfortable with the idea of perhaps discomfort being the standard moving forward.
So clearly, Oregon is not the only state with a checkered past when it comes to race. In fact, it seems like, you mentioned, the entire country is kind of grappling with how to reconcile its history. And one of the most prominent ways we've seen this is through the media, like today. Professor Chavez, have you noticed shifts in news coverage when it comes to reflecting on U.S. history, especially over the last couple of years?
Yes, and thank you for having me. I think you're starting to see a growing awareness of news organizations about their complicity in racism, either through omission, what they choose not to cover, or through actively stoking racial violence. And so you've seen a number of publications that have made amends for it through public apologies. The Orlando Sentinel, for example, apologizing for their complicity in stoking extrajudicial murder. Other publications that have failed to cover the civil rights era and some of the injustices. Terminology. Probably one of the more higher profile cases is National Geographic issuing a public apology when they released their special issue on race, talking about how they had supported this social hierarchy of whites at the top, people of color at the bottom, through their imagery over the course of decades doing it. And they did it in a very public way. And so I think people are becoming more reflective of those practices. At the same time, there's still a danger of relegating that to the past. Those were practices that we don't engage anymore. When there's still practices that are very problematic, newsrooms, for example, are still predominantly white, which means that news organizations don't have access to a diversity of perspectives. And that, in turn, makes them less ill-equipped or more ill-equipped to capture the perspectives of the society at large. And so these practices still endure. News organizations are also – we give them a special space in society. We look at them to be objective. Versus, say, television and film, in which we think of as creative efforts and therefore inherently subjective. But news organizations act politically all the time by choosing to tell certain stories and not tell others, or including certain voices and not including others. And so they still act very politically. It just goes under the pretense of objectivism.
So I think something that, you know, is a part of this conversation is obviously language. Mm-hmm. And some news outlets in the U.S. have changed their approach when covering hate and racism, white nationalism. One recent example is shifting from calling President Trump's tweets or language racially tinged to full on calling them racist.
Right.
And that's something that, as an example, NPR switched in the last year. So, Professor Chavez, how has language or terminology changed over the years when reporting on race and white supremacy?
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed any other major shifts in language?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there are kind of two things. Language itself is always changing, and so society uses different terms all the time. And so, you know, you think about how news coverage happened during the 50s, 60s, they're probably using different terminologies to capture different kinds of communities. So just language is always evolving. And I think under this current administration, news practices have had to evolve and pretty quickly. The one that you'd mentioned was, do you call President Trump's tweets racism or racially tinged? And Elizabeth Jensen, who's the ombudsperson for NPR, spends a lot of time trying to wrestle with some of these issues. And so she gives the example of the tweet that President Trump gave around the squad and go back home and some of the implications that were there. And NPR had made the conscious effort to call it racist rather than racially tinged. Some of the struggle is when you call something racist, you, in some ways you're ascribing motive, which journalists are not necessarily inclined to do. Trying to ascribe motives to why people are doing things. But in this case, Elizabeth Jensen had argued that, well, we have a history of the term itself, go back home, go back to where you came from, that has a history that's racist. And I think there's just sort of a building amount of evidence of the president's intentions also. So I think at that point you feel a little bit more comfortable calling something racist. But still there are other terms that are go less contested, whether we call somebody undocumented or illegal. Mm-hmm. Has political implications. Those have profound implications. You know, describing somebody in terms of their economic capacity or their criminality. And so all of these things have important implications. And even terms like Hispanic, Latino, African-American, which are also political because they are all-encompassing and include their own forms of erasures. I mean, you're talking about very diverse communities that we collapse under these collective terms.
So if you're just tuning in, you are listening to KLCC's Community Conversation, Racism, Hate, Oregon's History, and the Media. There's still time to be part of the conversation. You can send an email to news@klcc.org, tweet at us at @KLCCEugeneOR, and use the hashtag KLCCOnAir, or you can leave a comment on the Facebook live stream. So going back to the question of language, Dr. Moreland Kapuya, does it matter to the group that's being discussed that they're called something that they have chosen?
Narrative in general matters the most. And I would say that narrative, interestingly enough, it drives and shapes underlying assumption. And what we know is that when assumption takes place, assumption dictates behavior. And when we're called certain things, it does conjure up not just images, but it drives action. And so it's the one thing that we have to be careful about. And as I was thinking about this whole narrative in general, one of the things that was noted, I think NYU mm-hmm. did a study just recently within this year that looked essentially at, they had sort of used artificial intelligence and looked specifically at what they called online hate, or an increase in online hate language and offline violence in over 100 cities. And it built this, with this artificial intelligence, they built sort of this machine learning model that essentially looked at over 537 million tweets. And then, of course, we know that correlation doesn't equal causation, but it was interesting to look at this particular study where they said in 100 sort of urbanized cities that you essentially had an increase between the time frame of 2011 and 2016, an increase in what they called discriminatory tweets, both direct and indirect, and the rise in hate crimes in particular. Now, the study did not include language, harassment, but it did only include crimes. And essentially what was seen was that there was a directly proportional relationship that in between that time frame, 2011 to 2016, that as tweets, racist and discriminatory tweets increased on social media, so went violent acts and violent crimes. Now, I thought between that time period is very interesting. We started the conversation before the conversation here, and one of the things that came up was, well, is the geopolitical environment that we find ourselves in, is it different than it was 5-10 years ago? I think we can agree that the tenor and the tone is different, but the underlying subtext has always been the same. There's been this underlying, drive to accentuate difference. And if we go back really to kind of our earliest points, when we think about it, you know, we all watch Sesame Street, and there's a really famous episode. One of these things is not like the other. I'm sure most people remember that. And in kindergarten, in our very formative years of education, we're in a space where we learn very early on to identify difference, that a triangle is different from a square, that red is different from black. And the thing is that in that context, it's wonderful to learn about difference, but we're never given any context for it. So then what happens is that we grow up into adults that continue to accentuate differences with no context. And then that then grows into discrimination and racism. And so there's a very real rich opportunity to pay attention to what we do, what we say, because it is very powerful. It shapes the psyche. It shapes behavior. And I think we have a responsibility. But going back to this new NYU study on the tweets increased in tweets between this period, the other thing that was happening between 2011 and 2016 is Obama was our president, and we had the increase in the rise of the birtherism, you know, comments, and of course Trump starting to bid for his campaign for what has now become the presidency. And a lot of the language that came out of that was a lot of othering. And also very, very much so accentuating the fact that in the Obama presidency, there was, in some groups, this interpretation or perception that there were groups of folks in the country that were left out. And so there were dog whistles to say, this black man who is president, who identifies as a black man as president, and he has taken care of everyone else but you. And the question becomes, well, who is the you and who are you talking to, right? And in that conversation then became, now that we feel like we've been excluded, we need to get our country back. We need to make it, we're talking about narratives here still. We need to make America great again. Again indicates that it at some point lost its greatness, right? It indicates a number of things. And what we see is the pendulum, as Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg said at the very beginning, and this was what gave me hope in 2016 when 45 was catapulted into office. She said that the real American symbol is not the American eagle. It's the pendulum, because it swings so drastically and so extremely, and it will swing again, hopefully in 2020. But the case in point, though, is that we have this very extreme language that became acceptable. And so folks began to see very clearly that you can not be a good person, you can use bad language, you can bully others, you can talk bad about folks, and you can still achieve the highest office in this country. That is a very powerful message. And if that is how you do it, then I don't mind participating in it. So it makes sense to me that you would see a rise in crimes in conjunction with a rise in negative narrative. So I would just say that the narratives are very important, and to the extent that we shift them is the extent that we can move towards, I think, decreasing the risk of violence.
So you mentioned talking to kids when you brought up Sesame Street. Yeah. And, you know, something that, you know, I think it's such an easy instinct when you're explaining to your child who may ask you, well, why is so-and-so different from me in my class? Why is the color of their skin different? And what I've been told is you should not say we're different on the outside, but we're all same on the inside. Why?
Well, it really is about this idea that I think if we think about the word difference inherently, you know, viscerally, it evokes a certain image. Certain things come up in our mind when you hear the word different, and different has never really been attached to anything that felt good, right? So it is, how do we effectively help reshape, redefine what different means? That different should be attached to things like beautiful. Different means powerful. Different means that we get an opportunity to grow. Different means innovative. Different means creative. And to the extent that we reshape and reframe what that means is the extent that we move someone towards changing. And so it's not as much as telling someone, oh, we're the same on the inside. It's to help people appreciate that there is a very important functional role for difference. That's okay, that everything should not be the same. And in fact, if it were, the world would be such a dark, dark place. And we are interested in the light. As many bright lights that can shine to blot out the darkness is what I am asking for. So it's okay to be different. It's okay to shine a little brighter over here in that way. So it is, how do we effectively take this word that in many ways has been used and understood as being something not so positive and turn it around for good? And that's what I mean by offering context. So it's okay that blue is different from red. Red has a functionality that blue doesn't, but they both do something quite important. Right. And that's what I meant by giving that example of, you learn about difference with no context. And then we grow up as adults with only being able to identify the difference to use to separate out something, because that's what you're supposed to do. Identify the difference and separate it. But then we never get back to why, how we effectively make those things work together. And I think we have a responsibility in school. It's one of the primary places that I think we have to do that. And we've also seen in this current era that there's been a rise in hate and in crimes in, you know, in elementary, high school, colleges. So we have, I think we definitely have a responsibility to get back to reshaping and changing that narrative.
So you're listening to KLCC's Community Conversation, Racism, Hate, Oregon's History, and the Media. We did get several voicemails, and I'd like to go to one now. This is Sherry.
This is Sherry from Bend, Oregon, and I'm just wondering what the panel's ideas are for the best way for white people to discuss the issue of racism with people who may not even be aware of their own racism or bring up issues of justice so that we can be productive and not make people defensive.
So, Eric Ward, why don't you start us off?
Certainly. So, you know, I would say to Sherry that I think those conversations are critically important. It's important to understand that they aren't often comfortable. We are a society that doesn't talk about race and racism outside of cliches in a significant way. And these are hard conversations. And, you know, some guidance that I have for folks is to start with values, right? Or to first find the things that we have in common. So I like to believe that the majority of Americans believe that we all have the right to live, love, work, worship, free from fear. If we both understand that, it's easier then to talk about what are some of the barriers and challenges in ensuring that that happens for everyone. I think it's important not to start the conversation off by calling someone racist. It is going to be a quick way to end that conversation. Starting with values then allow you to try to have a conversation around pinpointing what the challenge is, what the specific behavior is, how something may have made you feel, a specific piece of policy. I think it's really critically important for us to start those conversations that way. I think, too, we should understand we are not missionaries, right? People aren't going to be converted, right? It is helping people build the skills, the tools, the model to begin to have conversations around race. And we do that by opening conversations on race and racism. We just have to lean in and understand at the end of the conversation that person may not be with us. And that's okay for now.
So we have an email that I want to get to. This is from Michael Dunn, because you were talking about calling someone racist, using that term to identify someone. Is it important to ascribe the term racist to the office of the president or to the person, Donald Trump?
I think everyone is going to have different opinions. My argument would be Donald Trump has certainly said things that are racist. Donald Trump certainly has supported policies that I would define as racist, meaning they have a disparate impact on people of color and seek to dehumanize people of color. I think that it is fine to point those things out. I think it is unbecoming of a president of the United States to be promoting the dehumanization of other Americans based on race. But I think it's less important. We spend an inordinate amount of time trying to figure out if an individual is racist or homophobic or sexist or whatever, right? I think much more serious attention needs to be made on the impact of a person's statements or the policies that they are promoting on communities, right? Racism really undercuts what I think are the highest aspirations of the United States of America. The idea of all people, all citizens, having access and opportunity in our society. And regretfully, we have a president who is hostile to that highest value.
So I want to dive more into the president and the 2020 election and so much more, but we are going to take a short 1 minute break. Listeners, there's still time to send us questions about what you just heard, or maybe you have a different question. Either way, we want to hear it. So email us at news@klcc.org, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook live stream. You can also tweet at us and use the hashtag KLCC on air. We'll be back in just about a minute. Welcome back to KLCC's Community Conversation, Racism, Hate, Oregon's History, and the Media. I'm Ani Katz, and I'm here live in KLCC's Selco Performance Hall with a panel of experts on race, mental health, and the media. So we're joined by Professor Chavez, Eric Ward, and Dr. Moreland Capuya. So before the break, we started talking about the 2020 election a little bit and the president. So let's dive right back in. It's coming up, the 2020 election, in case you are living under a rock.
Yes.
Sometimes something I wonder about is that there are a lot of people who have been emboldened by the Trump administration who have beliefs that until he was president weren't usually expressed in the national dialogue. If Trump isn't back in office in 2021 for whatever reason, what happens to the more extreme people who belong to his base? Eric Ward, do you want to get us started?
I will. We do have elections coming up, and it's easy to focus on national elections, and we should. It's an important part of civic life. But I would argue that while important, elections don't hold the full answer. There is a debate happening in America right now around who is an American and what will America look like. And it is a profound debate around citizenship and national identity and participation. It will be a debate that will outlast Donald Trump. This is much less an election about Donald Trump and much more of an election around what type of democracy do we choose to be? One that is grounded in inclusion, transparency, and accountability of government, or one that is shaped around the idea of exclusion? This is a conversation around who we see ourselves as, right? And who do we include in the American experiment? So it is significant. His base will not go away, regardless of the outcomes of this specific election. We are in a new moment in American life where we are dealing both with the vestiges and present-day reality of systemic racism and bias that none of us created, none of us were here, and with the arising reality of social movements that are committed to authoritarian and totalitarian rule in this society. And it is a significant fight in our country, and it will continue to play out for decades.
So we got a comment on social media that relates to this, and they wanted to know, where do we go from here? They mentioned that they have cut off close friends because of differences in political, ethical, and religious beliefs. How much more divided can we get? Is there a tipping point? Who wants to take that one?
So these conversations are not new. They happen again and again and again. We almost seem to be locked into this perpetual cycle of describing who are we as a country. It tends to happen around election times. It also happens to happen around census because that's when you get a sobering fact of, well, the country will look different. That's a fact. There is no going back. So if you look at the demographic projections, the country will look different than it does today. That is going to happen, right? That is inescapable. And so you get these anxieties that happen around what the country will look like. And we just can't seem to get out of that conversation. I think the difference is that political parties had once been apprehensive about engaging that conversation so antagonistically in the way that it has done. And I think what the past election has shown us is that is a successful strategy. Can it be duplicated? Can it outlast Donald Trump? I don't know. Is it tied to an individual? We won't know that yet. But I think what we did learn in the 2016 election is that could work. You know, that would have been unthinkable 4 years before. In fact, when Rove was talking about the presidential campaign, it was very conciliatory, trying to be more inclusive, that the GOP needed to change their marks. 4 years later, that had been completely abandoned and had been openly antagonistic. So I think it's just a matter of contestation, right? Like, it's a site of struggle. You're going to have differing point of views. And so we're just seeing that right now. It's a fight being played out.
Do you think that that was President Trump's, now President Trump, but do you think that it was his campaign kind of switching that conversation, or do you think that was kind of where the conversation was going to go no matter what?
I think it was an individual that really launched that campaign and then did it winningly so. So if there, you know, whatever you can say, I mean, it was an effective strategy and it mobilized a ton of people. And you're starting to see local elections at the more local level take on that same strategy to varying degrees of success.
So Oregon recently passed several pieces of legislation requiring schools to teach a more inclusive history. These laws are to ensure that the significant contributions of people of color and minorities are highlighted alongside the names that we all learned in fourth grade, like Lewis and Clark or Eugene Skinner. Dr. Moreland Capuya, why is it important to teach children about these successes in addition to making sure we address some of the state's more painful chapters? And I can just to give an example of something we recently aired on KLCC. The Triple Nickels, or the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion, was the nation's first black paratroopers. They recently got a historical marker in Pendleton. They were deployed there for a few months in 1945. And while they did a lot, like smoke jumping and finding stray Japanese balloon bombs, they also faced a lot of racial prejudice when they lived in Pendleton, Oregon.
Yeah, so I think it's important for multiple reasons to have history sort of effectively widen the bench when we think about history. We've seen probably in the last few months the recent success with the 1619 Project in the New York Times and the USA Today. And I think any time folks are able to see themselves and to learn more about themselves, it does a few things. It builds a sense of community and it strengthens identity. And we know that when folks feel reassured and they feel like they are being seen and heard and appreciated, that tends to increase their ability to feel like they can participate in the larger global economy. And that's what school is about. That's what education is about. It's about helping to build confidence and self-efficacy. So this idea that we look at all of history and everyone that contributed to it helps to build that this idea of self, you know, building self-efficacy and confidence. But the other thing it does is there are studies that show when you talk about and educate on the history of discrimination, that it actually decreases the risks that people will repeat that. In other words, that when young folks are learning about slavery and racism and discrimination and bias and its impact, not just currently but historically, that they are less likely to repeat that pattern. And I think that is critically important, that we educate, that we demonstrate to young folks and sort of emerging adults that's the way that we teach a different way and a better way. And so I was actually incredibly proud of that, this idea of sort of shoring up identity, this idea of teaching a more complete story and giving a more complete picture. And thirdly, it's about shifting the narrative as well. Because, you know, I think oftentimes there are certain groups have the history in America has been told, mostly or predominantly about slavery, but African and African Americans, there's a history that precedes slavery. There's a history of contributing to great intellectual property, whether it's math, engineering, all sorts of fields, science that African Americans and Africans have contributed to. And so as one example, I think that that's important, again, in terms of esteem building and helping to elevate a particular group and community and improving the psyche. Because if I have convinced you that you are nothing and that you have nothing to contribute, then it keeps you in this sort of vicious cycle of not feeling like you can contribute. So I think it's actually quite incredible and very powerful effectively widen the bench in terms of offering perspectives on history.
Some schools and municipalities across the American South are removing the statues of Confederate soldiers and historical markers that honor people with outdated ideologies. As we've seen multiple times, this act can inflame racial tensions. Here in Oregon, there have been calls to remove pioneer statues and rename buildings, all due to the actions and ideologies that these things represent now. Professor Chavez, what do you think about the hesitancy, either in the South or mm-hmm. here, to remove these markers or statues?
Right. And I get it. People are invested in a certain type of history. We also give history that power that we think of it, again, to be objectively true. But societies change. Like, the only static society is a dead society. So I think it's really fair to always renegotiate what our monuments mean, what we collectively agree to as being part of our community and what is meaningful to our community. So going to my office every day, I'll pass by one of the pioneer statues. And I know on our campus where we have interrogated the names of Dee Dee Hall and Dunn Hall. And I think the approach that President Schill took was smart. I mean, there's a lot of insight there. But one is, not all monuments are the same. They impact people in different ways. And so to try to ascribe impact and meaning of these various kinds of monuments, you know, and I, if I'm recalling correctly, some of the criteria that were used were, was the individual involved directly in oppression or genocide? Was there any kind of redemptive value that that person took? Did it dishonor the university in any kind of way? And so I think taking evaluative measures of trying to assess meaning in case-by-case basis is probably a smart way to go.
So going back to the U of O campus and actually OSU as well, mm-hmm. these pioneer statues and the men these buildings are named for, like you mentioned, Dee Dee or Dunn at the U of O or Benton Hall mm-hmm. at Oregon State, they also honor people that are part of Oregon's history. When KLCC covered these movements to rename or tear down, we'll get lots of comments about erasing, quote, our history. So, Eric Ward, what does this mean? Who gets to decide what's our history?
First, we have to start by acknowledging that it is our history, and our history is messy, and that is not unique in the world. But the way we address historic memory is by making a commitment to tell the full story. Telling a full story doesn't take away from the good things that happen. It just places it in a context that we all understand. And I think it's important that we understand and stop being afraid, right, of the contradictions that exist in historical moments. They really help us not to repeat the worst aspects. So that's one. The second that I think is really important is context, right? Context really does matter. It's important to acknowledge, right, in the South, most Confederate murals and memorials and statues were put into a place as a response to the civil rights movement, right? To reinforce the idea of Jim Crow and white pride. They were not put in place to remember the tens of thousands of Confederate soldiers who were killed in the U.S. Civil War. And that context matters. These were things that were put into place to intimidate Black people, right? Not to honor history. The third is geographic context also matters, right? It is different to have a memorial in the South than a battle monument memorial on the I-5 in Southern Washington, right? What we have to understand that at the end of the day, right, the Confederacy cost the lives of tens of thousands of Americans, including military veterans who were wounded or killed, right? Wearing and flying swastikas or folks who were allied against Nazi Germany or against the Confederacy is a slight to the cost of the Civil War in this country. And so adding context after context, I think, is really important. And that is what is often missing for those seeking to protect what are racist statues, not Confederate memorials.
So I just want to remind people you're listening to KLCC's Community Conversation, Racism, Hate, Oregon's History, and the Media. Speaking of context, I read the Little House on the Prairie series as a kid, and I loved it. Now I'm a mom, and I read the series to reading the series to my older child, and was shocked at how much of the book we had to read, and then pause and explain, and then read more and pause and explain. And I had no memory of this from when I was a kid. There's a minstrel show in the book where Pa wears blackface. And there are frequent derogatory comments in all the books about Native Americans. And again, I didn't remember any of this from my childhood because I don't think that that's what the conversation was 30 years ago. How should society respond to racism in past media, whether it's through racist language found in books or outdated stereotypes in TV and film? What's the best approach? Do you ignore them? Do you not read Little House on the Prairie anymore? What do you do?
I had a similar experience. So I took my daughters to see Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was a movie that I was a huge fan of as a kid. And then looking back at it as an adult, you're like, ooh, there's a lot of extreme stereotyping going on there. But it's that pause and explain, right? I don't think you make these texts disappear. And in some cases, if treated well and treated critically, they can serve as really important insights to who we were, but also who we're becoming. Some people don't want to engage in that conversation. And getting back to that topic of children and how do we approach this with children, they occupy a kind of a privileged position in society. We don't want to disrupt them with the ugliness of everyday life, but the world is messy and it's complicated and it's contradictory. So we often take this colorblind approach, or we don't want to talk about race or racism. So I'm thinking about Disney, for example, The Song of the South. Disney doesn't want to get involved in that conversation, so they have essentially made that film disappear. I would be surprised if anybody could buy it on the open market right now. They just don't want to get into it. But there are others that text that people are renegotiating. There's a comic book artist, Adrian Tamine, who looked at 16 Candles, you know, a John Hughes film, and said, I don't like the characterization of Long Dong Duck, Asian stereotyping, and created a comic book in response to that. Melvin Ellie's book is a scholarly book on Amos and Andy, trying to understand, by today's standards, widely seen as racist, but in its day widely enjoyed, even amongst African Americans. So how do you make sense of that? But I think it's that pausing and questioning, pausing and explaining that is important.
Right. So we have a Facebook question that relates to a question that that we were going to ask anyway. So I'm going to put them all together. The Facebook question is, how can I convince my 23-year-old grandson that displaying a Confederate flag on his vehicle is not a reasonable way to honor his Southern ancestry? And going from that, symbolism is important to members of hate groups. So this 23-year-old may think that this is honoring his Southern heritage. But for hate groups, whether it's a swastika, the 88 numerical code that represents the two H's for Heil Hitler, or more recently, the OK gesture that the Anti-Defamation League added to their list of hate symbols. During a trip to the gym recently, I saw someone working out with double lightning bolts on their calf tattooed, which I knew to be a symbol of the SS. These symbols, when they're spotted while you're just kind of going about your day, are jarring. So, Eric Ward, can you speak to why?
Because these symbols are frightening, right? They underscore violence and the targeting of vulnerable communities based off of their race, religion, gender, and sexual orientation, right? Thousands of African Americans were lynched under the symbol of the Confederate flag. It symbolizes something that is in direct opposition, right, to the American aspiration of equity in society. In addition to that, I think it's important, as someone who joined the U.S. Navy at age 18, right, I find it terribly offensive. And I have to imagine veterans who have served, who understand the history and lives lost of veterans during the Civil War. There is something inherently anti-American about the Confederate symbol. There is certainly something that reinforces the racism and white supremacy of America, but it is in direct conflict. And so are double S's and Nazi swastikas, et cetera. My father was in World War II, and it is offensive to look at these things and to understand what the cost was of defeating fascism and Nazism in America, and the treatment of black troops in America who fought that war overseas. I would just say, look, I'm not going to there's going to be no law that bans someone from wearing lightning bolts or tattooing a swastika or flying a Confederate flag. But I do have to say to the gym where you experienced what is a violent symbol in our nation, why is that gym allowing that in its private space? And why does that person feel comfortable in that space flying a symbol like that in our community? To me, that's the real challenge. Not folks who choose an ideology of exclusion and violence, but that we live in a society where non-governmental leaders, right? I'm not talking about freedom of speech and the First Amendment, but non-governmental leaders seem to have no problem tolerating that, right, in spaces and platforms that they do control. And that's the more frightening piece for folks of color and other marginalized communities.
I think what's also really easy is that, you know, we covered a couple months ago, there were swastikas spotted in downtown Eugene, yes, and we covered it on KLCC. And I think it can be easy to just kind of, you know, think to yourself, well, but nobody got hurt. It wasn't physical violence. And so, Dr. Morlin Kapuya, I want to come to you and ask, how might these symbols still instill a sense of fear? And how might that fear manifest itself? Because again, it's not a physical act of violence. It's just something that you're seeing somewhere else, on somebody else, maybe.
Sure. I before I answer that, I want to go back to sort of this display of public, like, memorials. I think that the question for many people now at this time and under these current conditions is, what can be archived and still appreciated as history, and what should remain publicly displayed? And I think that those are the types of discussions that I'd like to see more of, because it does speak to this type of, as we talk about symbols, to transition into the question that you've asked, that there are particular symbols that bring up certain things for folks, and it's traumatizing. And so if we're at a place where we're wanting to speak sort of to this greater sense of humanity, and if we are concerned with how people feel, how they operate, and what we think they can contribute, then I think we have to be mindful of how symbols impact underlying assumptions again and drive behavior. And I'll give just a brief example. Before many of us could speak, we knew what the golden arches meant. You don't have to drink Starbucks coffee to know what the symbol of Starbucks is. Right. So there is very powerful, when we talk about what is being communicated and why and how it impacts others, we know that the role of symbols has been very, very important in communicating a message. And those messages have not always been helpful. In many cases, they have been harmful. So when we talk about what it actually instills, this issue of fear is quite considerable. And it in fear, as we know, as I posed the question at the very beginning of our time here, when you ask individuals, is there a time in your life that you've never been afraid? Or is there any among us who's never been afraid? We know what it's like to be in a fearful state. You're not thinking straight. You're not making good decisions. You're not in a place that you feel safe, and you're in survival mode. And when folks are in survival mode, they do just about anything they can to seek safety. And if that means even participating in what may seem like violence to seek the safety, they will do it. So if our goal as a society is to reduce violence, to create safety for everyone to be able to thrive, then we have to be mindful about the things that induce and invoke fear and actively work to reduce them, because those are what we call triggers. And once we know better, as my grandmother always says, and we have a responsibility to do better.
So we just have just a few minutes left. So in each of your respective fields, where would you look at finding hope or hopefulness? And do you choose to reconcile, you know, history, Oregon's history? How do you look at that? And you can also, if you'd like to, touch on just the simple act of following current events and how you kind of, prevent that from being too emotionally draining. So do you want to start, Dr. Moreland-Kabuya?
Sure.
Yeah.
I think that we have to be intentional in seeking our joy. The reality is that we live in a complex and complicated world, and as human beings, we are complex and complicated. And life wasn't meant to be a bowl of cherries, but what we have to, I would say, reconcile is the reality that we're going to be living in spaces where we are utterly succeeding in one area of our lives and feel like we're failing in another. But it's finding ways to sort of peaceably coexist with these realities, and I think that there are multiple ways of doing that. Our history is very real. What we didn't talk about today is that our founding documents back in 1776 says that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. This country was birthed on exclusion. That's what it was birthed. We excluded people from the very beginning. And then we realized that in order to move towards greater ideals, that there were things that had to happen. People had to die. People had to fight. People had to build things and sacrifice. And so I do know that when folks come together where there's community, we reduce the incidences of chaos. Where there is love, we can certainly drive out hate. And where there is light, we certainly can drive out darkness. I have 3 children. And my hope is in those 3 children. We don't have another 200 or 300 years to wait for the world to change. And I would say that my children's existence is inextricably linked with everyone's children's existence. And if we care about that, then that should motivate us enough to make some changes.
Yeah. You go ahead, Eric.
So one thing I would just say is, you know, I'm talking to the 62-year-old white male veteran in Ontario, Oregon, who is trying to find work and can't find it, or working 3 part-time jobs. And I'm talking to the 17-year-old trans Latina, right, in Eugene, Oregon, who is struggling with the same issue. At the end of the day, there is much more that unites us in the sense that we just want a fair shake at life, right? And we all want to be able to love Oregon. And I think the next challenge is holding the space that we fundamentally believe that we all have the right to be American without challenge. And what I hope is that those in rural communities and urban communities understand that we've been pitted against each other under this narrative of an urban-rural divide, rednecks on one hand, thugs on the other. These are all just tropes that prevent us from really having conversations around the real issues that impact our lives, health, food, what happens with the future of our children. And racism is the barrier we have to cross to get out of that and have this real conversation.
So unfortunately, we have to end. I'm so sorry, Professor Chavez. I do want to thank our esteemed guests, Dr. Alicia Moreland-Kabuya, Eric Ward, and Professor Christopher Chavez for being with us today. Special thanks to the KLCC Public Radio Foundation and the WLS Spencer Foundation for sponsoring the conversation. The show was directed by Rachel McDonald. Jason Brown produced. Our sound engineer was Chris Heck. And our executive producer was Mallory Begay. Thanks to Elizabeth Gabriel, Aubrey Bulkley, and Brian Bull for their production assistance. I'm Ani Katz. Thanks for joining us.